DNA testing affects the convicted, the accused, and the victims. In April of this year, Nathaniel Hatchett was set free after serving 12 years in prison for a rape he didn't commit. DNA tests exonerated him of the 1996 assault. For another look at DNA testing, we have Donna McNeilan, professor and co-director of the Cooley Innocence Project in Lansing, Michigan, and Bruce Cook, founder and executive director of the Crime Victims Advocacy Council. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Donna, I'm going to start with you. Tell us briefly about the Hatchett case.
Well, the Hatchett case was a case where Mr. Hatchett was convicted about 12 years ago for the carjacking, kidnapping, and rape of a married woman. After the police picked him up on the crime, he was actually found driving the victim's car 4 days after the crime occurred. They took him in for questioning, and after a period of interrogation, Mr. Hatchett confessed to the crime. What we found during our investigation was that the facts that he gave in his confession were very different than the facts that the victim had given, and it sort of indicated to us that maybe someone who didn't have the facts exactly right had sort of fed the facts to him. Mr. Hatchett claimed that he came upon the car parked in his neighborhood in Detroit and that the car had been abandoned for a number of days. At the time, he was a high school student, and him and a group of friends skipped school, and his claim is that they sort of hot-wired the car and were out joyriding in it when the police picked him up. DNA evidence at the time, or just prior to trial, was taken, and it actually excluded him at the time of trial. However, the prosecution's theory at trial was that that exclusion wasn't really material because she was a married woman, and the source of the biological evidence that they obtained from the rape kit actually could have come from her husband. Surprisingly, nobody kind of questioned at trial why there wasn't a DNA test taken, or at least a DNA sample taken from the husband and compared to the biological evidence from the rape kit.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that in some cases or in some aspects of this case, there was sloppy police work. What led you to actually get him exonerated and get him out of jail?
Well, that's just the thing. I'm not sure it was sloppy police work, because what we found during our investigation was that at some point somebody actually did take a sample from the husband and found out that the husband was excluded. How that didn't get out is sort of beyond us. We're not sure what happened. What we ended up doing is retesting the husband's sample, retesting all the biological evidence from the crime, and then we found that the husband definitely was excluded. Mr. Hatchett was definitely excluded. And the only explanation based on the facts and the witnesses or the victim's testimony and her statements to the emergency room that she had not had any sort of consensual sex for a week led us to determine that the only source of the biological material could have been the perpetrators.
Very briefly, was anyone ever caught who was the actual perpetrator in this case?
Unfortunately, no. What there is right now is there's a national CODIS bank that has profiles of people who have been convicted of crimes. We did run the sample against that CODIS bank and have not gotten a hit.
Bruce, I'm going to turn to you now. You help crime victims cope, deal with their pain. How do people handle the news if they find out that the wrong person was in prison and then the true perpetrator is still free?
Well, no victim of a violent crime ever wants an innocent man to suffer needlessly. And DNA exonerations, we view it as necessary as a check and balance to ensure that justice is actually served. But the crime victims, when they find out it's the wrong person, it's tough. It's re-traumatizing. In two-thirds of the cases, they don't even find out who the person is from the DNA exoneration. About one-third they do. So that leaves them hanging again. Who is this person out there who committed this heinous crime?
There was an article yesterday in the Baltimore Sun where the victim was not notified that her abuser's sentence was reduced. That's just one of many cases where there's a question of how the criminal justice system communicates with victims. From your standpoint, from your advocacy standpoint, what would improve communications between elements of the criminal justice system and people who've been victimized?
Well, notification is a basic crime victim rights, one of the crime victim rights in 50 states now. So failure to notify that a sentence was reduced is failure to let a victim know on the status of the case, and that's a violation of the Crime Victim Bill of Rights in each state. We need a national Crime Victim Bill of Rights that has teeth in it, that doesn't just deal with federal but also with state and local. Right now, our national Crime Victim Bill of Rights deals mainly with federal.
From your standpoint, again, as a victim's advocate, how important is DNA? Because, as we mentioned earlier, DNA can lead to both convictions and exonerations.
It's very important, and I think from what I'm hearing, DNA backlogs are a serious problem. They need funding to get the backlog handled. And I suggest even that maybe offender fines and fees be an element to pay for that.
Donna, back to you. When you take a look not just at this one exoneration, but at the patterns, how does race play into the patterns of people who have been, that we at least discover, have been wrongly convicted and then exonerated?
Well, what we find is that race is a big factor. Eyewitness misidentification is one of the leading factors in these wrongful convictions. 75% of the first exonerations were the result of misidentification by eyewitness, and when the race factor comes into play, it amplifies those numbers.
Bruce, from your perspective, since eyewitness testimony is not always correct, how do you counsel victims in terms of their responsibility once they go on the stand, or do you talk to them about it at all?
Well, what we try to tell them is to be flexible, because the criminal justice system is not perfect. And there are flaws, there are errors made. We try to counsel them to be flexible to handle the different ways in which the trial plays out. Sometimes they get the right person and he gets off with a technical loophole, and that's very difficult. Sometimes they never find the person, and crime victims are left wondering forever who did this. This DNA exoneration is one way of getting the right person and making sure we have the right person.
Donna, not all, and I believe not most, exonerations are DNA-based. Do you work on the ones that are not DNA-based as well?
Well, currently we don't. We don't have the resources to do that. There are many clinics and many attorneys out there that are working on those cases, but it's not us.
So you specifically are sticking with DNA. And how, when you look at the pattern of cases that you've dealt with, is it often a case where DNA samples were taken, but what they said was not heeded, you know, as in the Hatchett case, or whether there was not a DNA sample taken at the time? I mean, what are we really talking about?
Most of the cases that we work with are cases that where the conviction occurred before there was DNA testing. Michigan statute only provides for inmates to bring a petition if they were convicted prior to 2001. So this was a rare case for us.
Now, Bruce, we talked earlier with a forensic scientist about the Debbie Smith Act. It was funding, or it is funding, forensic science investigations at the local and state level for the past 5 years. You just mentioned funding. Do you have an advocacy position on continuing or renewing this act, which could help at least mitigate some of the backlog in DNA testing?
We're not only in favor of that, we're in favor of state and local funding to supplement it so we can reduce this backlog. A crime victim is waiting out there thinking that, you know, this is the right person and that this person's now doing time for this rape or this murder. It's very important that any kind of DNA testing that might prove guilt be established early on so that there's not this secondary victimization or trauma again when they find out they got the wrong person.
And Donna, how is Hatchett doing now that he's been released?
You know, it's too early to tell. He's not been out a very long time, and I got to be honest, there's no resources for him. A lot of things have changed in the last 12 years. He's struggling, and, you know, I'm not sure how that's going to work out.
Well, Donna, Bruce, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Donna McNeilan is a professor and co-director of the Cooley Innocence Project at Cooley Law School in Lansing, Michigan. And Bruce Cook is the founder and executive director of the Crime Victims Advocacy Council.